This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The HBO series Boardwalk Empire started its fifth and final season last Sunday. Our first guest is the show's creator and showrunner, Terrence Winter. He also wrote many of the episodes. Martin Scorsese is one of the executive producers and directed the pilot. Scorsese and Winter also collaborated on the film The Wolf of Wall Street, for which Winter was nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. He's won 4 Emmys for his work on The Sopranos, on which he served as a writer and an executive producer. He spoke with Terry Gross last Thursday. Boardwalk Empire is about rival gangsters, corrupt politicians, and federal agents in Atlantic City during Prohibition. The series opened in 1920, on the day before Prohibition begins, when Nucky Thompson, the corrupt city treasurer played by Steve Buscemi, is about to initiate his plan to keep the city awash in bootleg liquor and make a fortune doing it.
Mr. Mayor, friends, fellow members of the city council, as you know, in less than 2 hours, liquor will be declared illegal by decree of the distinguished gentlemen of our nation's Congress. To those beautiful, ignorant bastards.
After 4 TV seasons of dramatizing life in the 20s, the new season of Boardwalk Empire jumps ahead to 1931, 2 years before the repeal of Prohibition. Nucky is hoping to use his liquor connections to go legit as soon as Prohibition ends. He's in Cuba, where he's trying to convince the head of Bacardi Rum that Prohibition will be ending soon and Nucky should be Bacardi's U.S. distributor.
Tom Maxime, I have a distribution network already in place. Deepwater port on the Florida coast, agreements with rail lines and trucking companies. The day repeal passes, I intend to be open for business, legally, in the thirstiest country on earth, with Bacardi Rum as my most exclusive offering. Can the two of us come to an arrangement?
A scene from the new and final season of Boardwalk Empire. Terrence Winter, welcome to Fresh Air. So why did you want to tell the story in the first place about a group of gangsters during Prohibition?
Well, there was 2 reasons. One very selfish reason was that when HBO gave me the book Boardwalk Empire, which was essentially a history of Atlantic City, they said, you know, why don't you read this thing and tell us if you think there's a TV series in there somewhere. And, oh, by the way, Martin Scorsese is attached to this. So without even reading the book, I said, yes, there's a TV series in this and I'm going to find it. When I went home and actually read the book, there was a chapter about this guy, Nucky Johnson, who we later fictionalized as Nucky Thompson, of course. And he was the county treasurer of Atlantic City during the Prohibition years. And Prohibition was really the single event that made organized crime possible. It made millionaires out of criminals overnight, allowed them to make money to infiltrate other businesses, and it was just an incredible boon to people of that ilk. It was also sort of the flip side of what I had been doing on The Sopranos for 8 years or so. If The Sopranos was sort of an exploration of the end of organized crime or sort of the waning days of organized crime, the Prohibition years was the beginning of that same thing. And it also, you know, the more I looked at it and read about it, there were so many things in the 20s that were really a mirror to current society. Essentially, the illegal alcohol business is the drug business. I mean, these are basically drug dealers. The fact that we're still debating women's rights, the fact that the Scopes monkey trial, for example, was in 1924. We're still debating evolution almost 100 years later. So I thought, God, what an opportunity to really do a show that holds up a mirror to the current society, and it's 90 years in the past.
So another similarity between then and now is that you've got a lot of people just back from a war. And World War One is the backstory for so much of what happens in Boardwalk Empire, because you have people who, young people who came back damaged by living for so long in the trenches and by having to kill so many people and for coming home and feeling dead inside.
Right.
And not caring if they risk their lives. And I want to play a scene that relates to that. And this is from the first season of Boardwalk Empire. And you wrote this episode. And this is a scene with Nucky Thompson, who's, you know, the boss of Atlantic City. And he's still kind of part corrupt politician. He's the treasurer of Atlantic City and part gangster. He's not full-time gangster yet.
Yes.
And Jimmy Darmody is a guy whose life he feels responsible for reasons too complicated to get into. But anyways, Jimmy Darmody's back from the war. He's young. He's in his 20s. He's kind of damaged by the war. He's working for Nucky, but he's made a big mistake that cost like four or five lives and is making Nucky look really bad. So Nucky is really angry with him. And here's the scene.
Are you that stupid? I have no idea how in over your head you are.
I know it's a lot.
Did I not tell you to slow down? I tried to give you money. I tried to
tell you I'm not a kid anymore.
And killing. That makes you a man?
No.
You got brains, kid. You got a future.
Look, I still got a future. We both do. The war, Nuck. The things I did over there. You live in a trench for months on end. Killing the smell of death. Nucky, I'm nothing but a murderer. You know how many times I went over the top? They call me a hero. The truth is, I didn't care anymore. I didn't care.
You're home now. You got a family.
I'm going to hell, Nuck.
I'll knock it off.
No, I am.
You are not.
Well, I'm 22 years old. I see fellas like Luciano, fancy suit, diamonds.
Is that what you want?
That's what you want, too. That's what we all want. At least I got the gumption to take it.
You'd be very foolish to underestimate me, James. I could have you killed.
Yeah, but you won't. Look, you can't be half a gangster, Nucky. Not anymore. Let me help you.
That's Michael Pitt and Steve Buscemi in a scene from Boardwalk Empire, an episode written by my guest, Terrence Winter, who's the creator of the series. So there's a line in the clip that we just heard where Jimmy says to Nucky, "You can't be half a gangster." That became kind of like a catchphrase. That was a line a lot of people remembered from the series. When you wrote that line, did you think, "Yeah, this line's going to stand out"?
No, I really had no idea. It was, it for some reason, resonated with people, but it really didn't make sense. You know, basically what Jimmy was saying was, you know, the low-level corruption, the little extortion, election rigging stuff is over. If you're going to survive now, the game has completely changed. You know, once alcohol became illegal, it was very clear that there were millions of dollars to be made, and there were people who were going to be pulling a lot of triggers in order to make that money. Unless you were fully capable and willing to be one of those people, you are not going to survive. So that was basically it. This is now moving into a level that Jimmy did not think Nucky was comfortable with or capable of being involved in. And of course, the big irony is that Jimmy tells him you can't be half a gangster anymore. The thing that makes Nucky fully a gangster is killing the very person who tells him that.
Yes, which he does at the end of season two. And you wrote that episode two, and we have a clip of that standing by.
Okay.
So, you know, in the clip that we just heard, Jimmy says, yeah, you can have somebody kill me, but you're not going to. And at the end of season two, after the relationship between Nucky and Jimmy has deteriorated more, Nucky sets Jimmy up to have a meeting with him in the pouring rain. Nucky's men are surrounding him. And Nucky pulls a gun on Jimmy. And here's the scene. Jimmy speaks first.
This is the only way we could have ended, isn't it?
This is your choice, James.
I died in the trench years back. I thought you knew that. So who's gonna do it? Manny? You? Eli?
I am.
My first time I vomited after. 2 days straight. Second time, I didn't even think about it.
So stupid.
Just try to make yourself calm.
You had everything going.
Breathe, Nuck.
Your whole life.
You'll get through it. All you gotta worry about is when you run out of booze, and you run out of company. And the only person left to judge you is your...
You don't know me, James. You never did. I am not seeking forgiveness.
Okay, putting a period at the end of that sentence.
I think that was an exclamation point.
Good point. And that was Steve Buscemi and Michael Pitt in a scene from the second season of Boardwalk Empire, a scene written by my guest Terrence Winter, the creator of the show and the executive producer and showrunner. And Boardwalk Empire just started its final season. Did you know when you wrote the earlier scene where Nucky says, "I could have you killed," and Jimmy says, "Yeah, but you won't," that Nucky would end up shooting him himself as time went on? Like, how far ahead do you look when you're writing an ongoing series like this?
Well, I knew that would happen eventually. I just didn't know when. And as the series progressed, it became very clear toward the end of season two that it had to happen then. Going any other way, I would not have believed it. If we're saying that Nucky is now going to be a gangster and is going to be in charge of all these men, for him to let Jimmy off the hook would have just felt like a TV show to me. I would have watched that as a viewer and said, "Oh, okay, they're just trying to keep this second lead of the show alive," and you would have lost me. And I think part of what makes the show special for me is that we try to be as true to the characters as possible and let the chips fall where they may in terms of actor deals and commitments and that sort of stuff. We made a deal with ourselves early on The Sopranos that we would never keep a character alive because we liked the actor who portrayed them, because we felt we would never kill anybody. You know, you start to get very close to people, and if you start to let personal relationships bleed into the work, it really colors it in a bad way. So that was the case here. You know, even though I knew how enormously popular that character was, and I really didn't have any idea what we would do after it, it was the right thing to do creatively.
When you kill off a character, isn't there a part of you that feels really bad because you know you're firing an actor?
Yeah. It's the hardest part of my job, making that phone call, you know, putting people out of work. So it's tough. I mean, I've made a lot of those tough phone calls.
You make the phone calls yourself?
Yeah. I make the call before the actor reads it in the script or hears it from somebody on the crew.
Do they know what's coming when they get a call from you? It's kind of like, uh-oh.
Yeah. I actually had called one actor and I said, "Hey, it's Terry Winter." He said, "Well, I guess I'm dead." I said, "Well, you're fine. Your character's dead, but you're okay." I said, but yeah, I mean, that used to be the joke with David Chase. You know, you didn't want to get a call from David as an actor, and suddenly I was in that position as a showrunner, and it was the same thing. But then even, you know, inadvertently over the years, I've called an actor to say, "Hey, I just saw a cut of the episode. You were terrific in it." And I can hear the trepidation in their voice. They think I'm calling to tell them they're getting killed, but I'm actually calling to say, "Hey, you were terrific in the last episode," or "Hey, let's have dinner," or something like that. So I started to learn to preface things with like an email, "Hey, I'll be calling. It's not about anything bad," or, you know, so try to see it from their perspective.
What's your exposure to organized crime? Do you have any?
Not really. I grew up in Brooklyn, you know, as a child there in the 60s and a teenager in the 70s. You know, I guess kind of by osmosis, you rub elbows with people who are involved in that life, so you can't really
avoid it. I grew up in Brooklyn. I really don't think I rub shoulders with people in that life. I rub shoulders with people in the garment industry.
I bet you didn't. You didn't realize
grocery
it.
Grocery stores. And
you never know who's standing behind you online. I mean, if you're aware and you know who's doing what and who owns what store and what club and that, you know, the people are around, you know, and I was a little more aware of it, I think, growing up. So, you know, I was interested in it. You know, somebody asked me recently, where did it begin for you, the fascination with this? And I traced it back to the movie Oliver, I think from 1968. I watched that and I wanted to be the Artful Dodger. I wanted to be in that gang. And it was just very exotic and glamorous. And then a couple of years later, I saw The Sting.
Be a professional pocket picker?
Pickpocket, yeah. I thought that was so cool. It seemed great. And then The Sting came out and I became fascinated with con men. And then I started to read, you know, books about the mob. And again, you know, just having been in New York and Brooklyn at that time, you know, it's sort of that stuff was everywhere. So just sort of, you know, soaked it in and was always interested.
Martin Scorsese is an executive producer of Boardwalk Empire, and he directed the film that you wrote, The Wolf of Wall Street, and he directed the first episode, the pilot of Boardwalk Empire. I read that he screened gangster films of different eras for you and the other people working on Boardwalk Empire when you got to work on the series. What were some of the things Scorsese pointed out about some of the films that he screened that you hadn't noticed yourself that you found valuable as a writer and producer?
Well, first of all, that entire month of going to Martin Scorsese's office and watching gangster films with him was the best film course you've ever had, times a billion. It's just getting to sit with him watching Rod Steiger as Al Capone, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, you know, all these classic films, and hear his live commentary. He's very much about truth and real moments and real performances. You know, he understands the juxtaposition of violence and humor, or having an incredibly tense scene and then letting the air out of it, let the audience breathe with a light moment. Some of Martin Scorsese's films that are very violent, Goodfellas, for example, Raging Bull at times, can be very funny. I mean, these guys are so absurd in some ways that you almost can't help but laugh at them. And I think The Sopranos was like that too. It was often very funny. I think a lot of times when we would write scripts on The Sopranos, we would compliment each other by saying how funny your script was, not how dramatic or how poignant. It was, God, your script was so funny.
Let's talk about The Wolf of Wall Street. Let's start with a clip. So Leonardo DiCaprio plays Jordan Belfort, who is a stockbroker, but then the company he works for is a victim of the crash of 1987. So he answers an ad for a broker, for a stockbroker, and shows up for his job interview at this storefront at a rundown strip mall. And, you know, this isn't really a legit brokerage house. It's a bunch of guys who know nothing about the markets trying to con people into buying really cheap stocks that are worthless and are going to basically stay worthless. But he's such a great salesman and con artist, and he's so unethical that he just cold calls a potential buyer and lies, sells a lot of stock, makes a big commission. And in the middle of this spiel, everyone in the office stops working so they can listen to him make this phone call because he's just so good at it. Here's the scene, and the company that he's selling the stock of is called Aerodyne.
Hello, John. How are you doing today? You mailed in my company a postcard a few weeks back requesting information on penny stocks that had huge upside potential with very little downside risk. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah, I may have said so.
Okay, great. Well, reason for the call today, John, is something just came across my desk, John. It is perhaps the best thing I've seen in the last 6 months. If you have 60 seconds, I'd like to share the idea with you. You got a minute? Name of the company, Aerodyne International. It is a cutting-edge, high-tech firm out of the Midwest awaiting imminent patent approval on a next generation of radar detectors that have both huge military and civilian applications. Now, right now, John, the stock trades over the counter at 10 cents a share. And by the way, John, our analysts indicate it could go a heck of a lot higher than that. Your profit on a mere $6,000 investment would be upwards of $60,000.
Jesus, that's my mortgage, man.
Exactly, you could pay off your mortgage.
This stock will pay off my house.
John, one thing I can promise you, even in this market, is that I never ask my clients to judge me on my winners. I ask them to judge me on my losers because I have so few. And in the case of Aerodyne, based on every technical factor out there, John, we are looking at a grand slam home run. $4,000, that'd be 40,000 shares, John. Let me lock in that trade right now and get back to you with my secretary with an exact confirmation. Sound good, John?
Yeah, sounds good.
Great. Hey, John, thank you for your vote of confidence, and welcome to the Investor Center.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
Bye-bye.
How'd you do that?
Just like that, I made $2,000. The other guys looked at me like I'd just discovered fire.
Great. Even better.
I was selling garbage to garbage men and making cash hand over fist. The only problem you're going to have is that you didn't buy more.
Boom! Shocker.
So I was selling them.
Fuego.
The way I looked at it, their money was better off in my pocket. I knew how to spend it better.
So that's a scene from The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio, and my guest Terrence Winter wrote the screenplay. So what interested you in this story? It's based on a memoir.
Well, you know, it goes back to my interest in con men. You know, Jordan was a very slick salesperson. There was a lot in Jordan's life that was very similar to my own. We were basically the same age. He was a very ambitious young kid who was kind of a hustler who grew up in Bayside, Queens. I was that same kid in Brooklyn. We both worked on Wall Street a mile away from each other in 1987. The crash of 87 was the thing that spun me into a different direction, becoming a lawyer and then ultimately going on to be a writer. That same crash sent Jordan out to Long Island to sell penny stock. That's where our paths diverged. But up until that point, there were a lot of similarities. And I felt like I really understood him. I understood that driving ambition and that willingness to cross lines in the sand, maybe engage in things that were not quite ethical or half-truths, as long as the perception was you weren't really hurting anybody. And then, of course, in Jordan's life, those lines in the sand kept getting further and further out into the ocean until he was really hurting people and ultimately hurting himself and his family.
You wanted to be rich, but did you want the kind of excess that Jordan Belfer has in The Wolf of Wall Street? Just,
No. I wanted to be secure.
The jewels and mansions and cars and planes.
None of that stuff has ever been important to me. And I just was the security to do what I want to do in life and just know that my family is secure. And, that's really what I wanted. And I didn't know it at the time. I probably think I perceived that I wanted to be rich. And I remember as a kid, I used to walk around Kings Plaza, the shopping mall in Brooklyn.
Oh, God, I remember that place.
I used to walk through Macy's and look at all the fancy furniture and think, one day I'm going to have this. That was how I used to inspire myself. Mm-hmm. That was the stuff that sort of fueled my ambition. I lived in this tiny little house in Marine Park. And I remember the Franklin Mint used to do these mini ingots that they would advertise in the back of the Daily News magazine. And at 15 years old, I sent away for those ingots thinking, when I'm a millionaire one day, I'm going to need stuff like this for my mansion. And I actually still have them. And I guess my millionaire friends will come over and we can look at my Franklin Mint ingot collection. And the funny thing is now, in my house in L.A., when my friends come over, I do take out my ingots and say, you just have to let me live this fantasy out. Here are my mini art treasures of the Louvre. And they come with a little magnifying glass. And I am doing that, but not in the way I imagined it at 15.
Terrence Winter, it's been great to talk with you. Good luck with the final season of Boardwalk Empire, and congratulations on
this series. Thank you. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me. This was really a lot of fun to do.
Terrence Winter spoke with Terry last Thursday. Winter is the creator and showrunner of HBO's Boardwalk Empire. The fifth and final season started last Sunday. The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, is the latest documentary miniseries from Ken Burns and Company, beginning Sunday night on PBS. It's a triple biography of Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor Roosevelt. It occupies 14 hours of TV time, stretched over 7 consecutive nights. And it's worth the time.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
That's Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivering the most resonant and famous line from his presidential inauguration speech of 1933. It was resonant because he was being defiant and optimistic in the face of the Great Depression. And it was famous because it was broadcast live to the entire nation on the relatively new medium of radio. It was filmed, too. And when we get to this moment in the newest Ken Burns nonfiction epic, about halfway through the Roosevelts An Intimate History, we both see and hear Franklin speak. That puts a lot of extra weight on Burns and his collaborators this time around. Since Theodore Roosevelt was born just a few years before the start of the Civil War, this new 14-hour joint biography of Teddy, his niece Eleanor, and Teddy's fifth cousin Franklin begins on familiar Ken Burns territory. There are lingering, slowly tightening shots of old photos and news clippings with actors hired to give voice to real-life historical figures. You could say Ken Burns once again is up to his old tricks, but they're still great tricks. Here's Paul Giamatti as U.S. Vice President Teddy Roosevelt remarking on suddenly ascending to the presidency after the assassination of William McKinley.
It is a dreadful thing to come into the presidency this way. But it would be a far worse thing to be morbid about it. Here is the task, and I have got to do it to the best of my ability. And that is all there is about it. Theodore Roosevelt.
That sort of audio role-playing gets trickier when we, the audience, are familiar with the historical voices being impersonated. Yet that obstacle is overcome here in spectacular fashion, thanks to some Emmy-worthy vocal acting and some equally Emmy-worthy script writing. Here's a perfect example of both from Part 4. It's the summer of 1921, and Franklin Roosevelt, age 39, has just spent a day sailing, swimming, and racing with his family, only to retire early because his legs felt weak and funny. It's the very moment when Roosevelt is stricken by infantile paralysis, by polio. And it's captured perfectly in this TV history because of the talent and passion of all involved. Edward Herman, who won an Emmy for his pitch-perfect portrayal of FDR in the made-for-TV movie Eleanor and Franklin way back in 1976, brings the man to life again here, and does so with such authority and accuracy that his vocal impersonation stands proudly alongside recordings of the real Franklin. Then there's the writing. Longtime Ken Burns collaborator Jeffrey C. Ward, a biographer of Franklin Roosevelt, wrote this entire 14-hour documentary, and also appears on camera occasionally. He emerges as this TV program's secret weapon, because when recounting the history of these three famous Roosevelt relatives, he's thoroughly invested and empathic. That's never more true than in the sequence where Franklin goes to bed tired and wakes up unable to use his legs. Ward, like Franklin, is a survivor of polio. And when Ward shows up on camera to describe how Franklin must have felt, it's a searingly raw, honest moment. Coming right after Edward Herman's impersonation of Franklin, it's a hauntingly potent 1-2 punch. Here's Herman as Franklin, then historian Ward.
The next morning, when I swung out of bed, my left leg lagged. I tried to persuade myself that the trouble with my leg was muscular, that it would disappear as I used it. But presently it refused to work, and then the other. By the end of the third day, practically all muscles from the chest down were involved.
It produces terror, unreasoning terror. You just can't believe that the legs that you've depended on simply don't work. And I don't know how to convey to people the sense that suddenly he could not go to the bathroom, he couldn't go for the telephone, he couldn't do anything on his own, and the limbs that, you know, he was a great dancer, he was a great golfer, he loved to run. None of that would ever happen again. He dreamed about it all his life, but he never could do it.
The other major players in the Roosevelts' An Intimate History are Meryl Streep and Peter Coyote. Streep, as Eleanor Roosevelt, brings her gifts for accents and acting and uses them both beautifully. This joint biography doesn't shy away from Franklin's infidelities and betrayals or his wife Eleanor's very independent life. Streep is marvelous. So is Peter Coyote, who has narrated many Ken Burns documentaries with the perfect pace and pitch and does so again here. Each of these Roosevelts, if studied individually, would be fascinating. But looking at them together like this is a revelation, a sort of storytelling synergy where the whole ends up being even more valuable than the sum of its parts. The Roosevelts' An Intimate History is biographical binge-watching at its best. In fact, I think it's Ken Burns' best, too. Coming up, we discuss The Great Gatsby with our book critic Maureen Corrigan. It's the subject of her new book, So We Read On. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has just published a new book of her own. It's about the novel she loves more than any other, the novel she considers to be the greatest American novel, The Great Gatsby. She's hardly alone in her evaluation of Gatsby, but she's perhaps unique in her ability to write in such a lively and engaging way about the book, its author, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the era in which it's set, the 1920s. In writing about Gatsby, she also writes about herself. She's read Gatsby more than 50 times, taught it to generations of college students, and grew up near an area where part of the book is set. Not near Gatsby's mansion, but near an area in Queens, New York, the characters drive through, which is described as the Valley of Ashes, because it was a dump for coal-burning ashes. Her book is called So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She spoke with Terry last Monday.
Maureen Corrigan, welcome back to Fresh Air. I so enjoyed reading your book.
Well, thank you, Terry. So, I know you're a Fitzgerald fan.
I am. I am. So I will ask you to confess something that you confess in the book, which is that you didn't especially like The Great Gatsby when you were assigned to read it in high school. Why didn't you like it then?
As far as I remember, I didn't like it because I thought it was boring. Not a lot happens in Gatsby. It's not a plot-driven novel. And I also thought, it's another novel about rich people. And I grew up in a blue-collar community. I guess, again, as so many readers do, especially when we're young, I was looking for myself in what I was reading. And Gatsby also famously is a novel that doesn't feature any likable female characters. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Fitzgerald thought it didn't sell well in 1925.
Well, as you point out, you read this book not for the story or for the characters, but for the voice, for the writing. So I want you to read the opening of The Great Gatsby, and it's one of the most famous openings in all of literature.
Yeah, this is Nick Carraway, of course, our narrator. In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. He didn't say any more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious natures to me and also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores.
What do you hear in that opening?
I hear a narrator who we can't completely trust because, of course, I've read Gatsby so many times. I've read it upwards of 50 times. When Nick tells us that he's inclined to reserve all judgments, I say, oh, really? Because he does a lot of judging in this novel. What I also hear is someone who comes from a world of privilege, who's trying to tell us that he's just a regular Joe, that he's not a snob. And so what the novel also is telling us right away is that this is a novel that's very alert to the nuances of class in America.
And by the end of the second page, we realize how disillusioned the narrator becomes by the end of the story. Because at the end of the second page, when he's talking about Gatsby, he says, Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It's what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men. So we know by the end of this book, he's disgusted with people.
He's disgusted with people, and we also hear that it's a retrospective story. You know, Nick is remembering events that happened 2 years earlier in the summer of 1922. One of the things that I talk about in my book is that Gatsby almost has the form of a film noir, where you have this voiceover remembering things that have taken place in the past, things that can't be changed, events that can't be changed.
You love hard-boiled detective fiction and film noir. What other similarities do you see between Gatsby?
Oh, my gosh. First of all, it's a violent story. Mm-hmm. There are three violent deaths in Gatsby. It's a story in which you get bootlegging, crime, explicit sexuality. And remember, this is 1925 when it was published. So it's pretty racy for its time.
Whoa, hang on. The explicit sexuality, we know explicitly that people have had sex. We don't explicitly read about it.
We don't explicitly read about it. But in chapter two, Nick is taken along by Tom Buchanan, who's one of the greatest characters in the novel. He's taken along on a joyride into Manhattan, where Tom takes Nick to the love nest that he's established with his mistress, Myrtle Wilson. And there's a drunken party in the love nest. So we know that there's infidelity, a lot of innuendo about people having sex outside of marriage, and a lot of drinking, and most importantly, film noir, hard-boiled detective fiction, and The Great Gatsby. They're all stories that are obsessed with the presence of fate. There's a very fated feel to Gatsby. Events that occur in the novel, they're foretold many times. That car crash in which Myrtle Wilson is killed, there are two other car crashes that precede that car crash. So a lot of events are predicted in this novel.
When you say fate, you mean doom.
Yeah, doom. That's right.
We're fated for a bad ending.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the beauty of The Great Gatsby, ultimately, that it talks about how noble it is to try, to try to swim faster, jump higher, you know, go farther, even though inevitably we're going to be pulled under by the forces of fate.
So I want you to tell just like the skeleton of the story of The Great Gatsby. So people who have not read the book or who haven't read it in a long time have some kind of plot structure to hang what we're talking about on.
Okay. In 30 words or less.
Good.
A young man named Nick Carraway moves to Long Island in the summer of 1922. And he's kind of got an internship. That's what we would think of it as, on Wall Street. And he discovers that he's living next door to this enigmatic character named Jay Gatsby, who lives in this over-the-top mansion. And he also discovers, as the plot unfolds, that Jay Gatsby has been carrying a torch for his, Nick's cousin, Daisy Buchanan, for years. And that Gatsby's whole purpose on living on Long Island is to be close to Daisy Buchanan and to rekindle the romance that they once had years ago. Things don't end well. after Daisy and Jay Gatsby get back together again, there's a break in the novel. There's a silence. It's almost as though Fitzgerald wanted to leave them their privacy for a while in the novel. But then Daisy's husband, Tom Buchanan, realizes that there's something fishy going on. He confronts Gatsby. And in the last act of the novel, as Daisy and Gatsby are driving on Long Island after this awful confrontation has happened in the Plaza Hotel, Daisy, who's actually behind the wheel, runs over her husband's mistress, Myrtle Wilson. Wilson's husband thinks that Gatsby was behind the wheel, and he goes after Gatsby and murders him. And the end. I mean, there are three bodies by the end of the novel. And the Buchanans leave town. They leave other people to clean up their messes. They're that kind of rich, privileged, entitled couple. And we've only got our narrator, Nick Carraway, who's kind of like Ishmael in Moby Dick. He survives the wreck and he lives on to tell us all. And he tells the story of Gatsby to us because he thinks Gatsby is the one pure soul in this entire story.
And, you know, one of the most famous things about The Great Gatsby is that Gatsby is always looking across Long Island Sound at the dock where Daisy lives. And he sees the green light that she has on at night on the dock. And he's always looking at that light and yearning for his dream, for her. And as you point out, when we first see him in the novel, he has his arms stretched out as if reaching for that light, and that light becomes a symbol of everything that he wants, everything he's remade his life to be near. And with that, I'd like you to read the very ending of the novel.
After people say the greatest ending in all of American literature. Yeah.
And it's Nick's voice that we're hearing here, because Gatsby's already dead at this point.
Gatsby's dead, yeah. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
You know, to put it in the words of Chinatown, it's Chinatown, Jake. like you can't escape the past. I don't know. Is that a terrible analogy?
No, it's not a terrible analogy. You can't escape the past, but isn't it noble to try? I mean, that's the message here.
To be the boat against the current.
Yeah, to be the boat against the current, even though you know failure and death inevitably await you. You're going, the doomed beauty of trying. That's what this novel is about.
You know, there was an article a few years ago in the New York Times that was headlined, Gatsby's Green Light Beckons a New Set of Strivers. Mm-hmm. And it followed a class in which the students, and a lot of them were first or second generation immigrants, were talking about what is their green light. And one of the students said her green light was Harvard. And another mm-hmm. student said, my goal is to make my parents proud of me. And I thought, like, you really can't turn Gatsby into that type of inspirational novel of, like, pursue your dream and you will achieve it.
I mean, I love that the students take that inspiration from Gatsby, especially students who are first-generation Americans. They're remaking themselves. They're strivers. I love that there is that positive element in Gatsby. But if it were just, you know, this kind of cheerleading slogan for the American dream, Gatsby would be alive at the end of the novel. He's not. So Fitzgerald famously has it both ways. He celebrates the effort, the striving, and he also lets us know that there are limits to the striving, that, you know, ultimately we all reach the dead end.
It's often said that self-transformation is the theme of a lot of American literature. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly one of the themes of Gatsby. And he both fails and succeeds in remaking himself. And where would you say that fits in into American literature in terms of personal transformation?
Mm. Well, we see so many con men in American literature. And I think of almost all of our great novels, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, Moby Dick, you know, on and on. At the center, there's someone who's pretending to be something that he's not. We're fascinated with the freedom that America allows us to sort of forge our own identities. But our smart American writers also know that it's not that easy and it's not that simple. And you carry the past with you. I mean, I think Fitzgerald felt that very much. He knew success so early as a young man in his early 20s with This Side of Paradise, his first novel in 1920. It was a hit. He was the toast of New York. But he was also that Midwestern boy from St. Paul, Minnesota, whose parents, you know, didn't quite measure up to their neighbors. His parents never owned a home, for instance. They always rented. Fitzgerald never owned a home. He always rented. He was always kind of on the outside looking in and hoping to be good enough for Princeton, you know, to be good enough for the crowd on the Riviera who he hung out with, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, the Hemingways, etc. So I think you get that sense in Fitzgerald of someone who remade himself, but was also aware at times in his life that he was pretending to be someone he was not. Even when he died in 1940, Fitzgerald was denied burial in his own family's plot in Rockville, Maryland, because the Catholic Church, Fitzgerald grew up Catholic, decided that his novels were a little too risque and they didn't approve of them. So Fitzgerald had to be buried in a Protestant cemetery. I mean, he's always being pushed out and told that he's not good enough.
So Gatsby was not that well received in its time, right?
No, not at all. It got mixed reviews. The literary readers, people like Gertrude Stein, Edmund Wilson, Gilbert Seldes, who was a critic and reviewer of the time who really got Gatsby, they loved it. Edith Wharton, although she thought famously that Fitzgerald should have done more with the character of Gatsby, but she generally liked it. The popular reviewers read it as a crime novel and thought, for the most part, that it was maybe just okay. There's a famous headline that came out in the New York World, and the headline reads, "Fitzgerald's Latest, a Dud."
You say something in your book about The Great Gatsby that I totally identified with, even though I'm not a book critic like you are. You write that you were afraid, if you were reviewing the book in 1925, that maybe you might not have realized how great it is. Or if it came to you over the transom now, a book like it, maybe you wouldn't notice. Mm-hmm. Can you just like elaborate on that fear a little bit?
Yeah, you know, Fitzgerald was known for tales of the Jazz Age, you know, in his novels and short stories, tales about flappers and their boyfriends. If this book had landed on my porch, as so many books do, I get about 200 books a week delivered to my house from publishers, I would have opened it and thought, oh, The Great Gatsby. The title is nothing to grab you. Fitzgerald always had trouble with the title up until almost publication day. He kept changing the title of The Great Gatsby, and everything else he came up with was worse. You know, Trimalchio and West Egg. I mean, awful titles. I think if I had opened the book and began reading, that Nick's voice would have grabbed me. And I want to think that I would have kept on reading. But you know, it's a hard call because I think about all the books I get these days that are, for instance, about dogs. I feel like we're still living through the Marley and Me phenomenon, and I get dog books every week. You know, so would I have gotten The Great Gatsby and thought, oh, another book about flappers? I don't know. That would have been a mistake, right?
Maureen, thank you for all that you do for literature and for our show. And thank you for helping me enjoy The Great Gatsby even more.
Thank you, Terry.
It's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Maureen Corrigan is Fresh Air's book critic. Her new book is called So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.